was to have it self-enclosed before Yontif, because since it's a complicated sugya, we don't want to leave it hanging over the course of the past month when we haven't really had normal shir. And that essentially we did. So what I would like to do now is do a sugya that's very related, but also stands on its own. And that's Jar D'Mamona, as you saw the Mar Mekomos today. That's something that's been a mysterious X factor in a lot of our discussions, and we kept saying the time will come and we'll have to address it head on. So that time has come. So I hope we can look at it both as its own sugya, but also one that allows us to plug back into what we discussed before Yontif and helps us to kind of review some of our concepts and apply them and do both, having had the sugya before Yontif and this one as a new sugya, but at the same time be able to bring back all of our connections to that Gemara. So to be fair for that, so we should spend a few minutes just reviewing what our major themes were from that opening month, so that we have some freshness in our mind. Again, it was some highly complicated stuff. And then we'll try to figure out what this Drara D'Mamona X factor is. And that should take us, I think, at least today and tomorrow. We'll see if it takes any longer than that. And then next on our agenda is to talk about Migo. We mentioned that was a base medal of topic that we want to look into a little bit. And then to try to move on to some of the other themes within the first parak. The semester goes quickly and there's so many major themes. Some shasugyas also that we'd like to cover within this parak, so we'll try to get as much done as we possibly can. So just to try to refresh our memory about the highlights of what we've seen so far. Again, because it's been a month. So what do we know? Very little. But what do we know about some of the basic building blocks of this sugya? So we know that sometimes people have a conflict. They are fighting over a piece of property, over some money, and the like. And the Chazal give us a number of different approaches. How many different approaches? Maybe as many as six. Right, so what were the approaches that we've seen? Yachloku, that's the one that's our sugya. What's the one that it's most often contrasted with? Kol D'Olam Gvar. We also saw Shudu D'Daini and Yehei Munach, Hamotzi Mechaver Olav Haraya, different concepts such as that. And we talked a little bit about what they mean and what their parameters are and why we would say one over the other. We talked about essentially achloku, meaning that we split the property between the two people, and in our case, at least, we do it with a shvua. There is a model, perhaps, of the achloku without a shvua as well. We didn't spend so much time on that. We talked about whether the achloku is a genuine psak, a bezdin ruling, that this is the halachic preference, that each person gets half of what he's getting, half of what he's fighting over, or is it a type of a pshara? Is it a settlement that essentially we don't have a better way of addressing it, so we might as well split it 50-50? And we saw the very real possibility that which one is true? Or that they're both true, right? That we saw that there seems to be a couple of scenarios in which we have the achloku, and it could be that they might both be true, that sometimes it's a real psak of bezdin, and sometimes it's an approach we take in order to resolve the quarrel between two parties the best we can. And we saw that ochsin plays a role according to some Rishonim, according to other Rishonim, not as much. And that was also something we spent some time trying to figure out, that maybe we'll do this when we have each party holding on to something. And we spent some time trying to figure out, what does it mean that you're holding on to it? Does that have a chazaka significance? Does that mean that we recognize you as legitimate owner of half, or does it just make you a player? How exactly do we assess the role? Is it a real chazaka? Is it a fake chazaka? Is it nothing? Is it just a connection? We spoke about that a little bit. And then we contrasted Kol D'Olam Gvar. Kol D'Olam Gvar, we saw, was a major discussion, right? What does Kol D'Olam Gvar mean? And so it seems to me, literally, you know, might mean might makes right. And when we have no other way of figuring out who's right, so we allow them to duke it out, which could mean either they actually duke it out, they see who's stronger, or they argue with proofs. And we saw that there were different perspectives in Rishonim as to whether this is itself Bezdin paskening in favor of the stronger one, or whether it is Bezdin removing themselves from the equation. Essentially a siluk, Bezdin saying, we can't figure out, it's not our role to figure out what's going on here, and we will be masalik ourselves. And we saw the Rush, who was a particularly interesting perspective, that Kol Dalam Gvar is a path to the truth, because the assumption that whoever is right will, and who knows who's right, will have more motivation to fight harder. A fascinating idea. And then we talked about Shud Didaini, about the idea that a judge will have the discretion, or a panel of judges probably will have the discretion to decide which party wins. And that was also a debate in Rishonim as to how that works exactly. Some Rishonim understanding that the Dayanim will try to make an educated guess as best as possible as to who is most likely right. So, for example, if two people are arguing, they both received a gift from someone, maybe we'll try to figure out who was closer to the giver, or who made more sense to be receiving the gift, etc., etc. While other Rishonim said it could be completely arbitrary, and that the Dayanim have the right to just say based on whatever they want, maybe even Shochat, it sounds in some sources. Probably not. But, excuse me, that they would have complete arbitrary discretion to give to whoever they want and to resolve things that way. And then sometimes we have a situation of Yehei Munach, where particularly if there is a need to punish somebody who's lying, so then a disputed property will remain in escrow, Achiyovo Olio. And we talked about that a little bit as well. And the major pursuit that the Rishonim took up in terms of bringing all these sugyas together was the question of when do you say one, when do you say another? And we saw various points evoked. What types of svaras were used to decide when you say one and when you say the other? And Ochsin is a major one, right? That if... excuse me. If the two properties are both holding on to something, we're more likely to say Yachloku. Chaluku Yacholios Emes, that if the split might reflect some true reality, it's another reason why we might be more likely to say it. The mysterious X factor of Dvaru D'Mamono, which we'll get to today. The question of the presence of a Ramai. What else was evoked? Anybody want to throw out anything else? Ikkel Amekel Malad Demilsa. If there's any hope that our process will lead to any further clarification. All of these were elements that various Rishonim brought in to the question of why we would pick any one of these paths over the other. Some of them are alluded to in the Gemara, rarely decisively, as we'll see again today, but the terms come from the Gemaras. And the Rishonim tried to sort it out and invoked these principles as reasons to go one way or another. And then we also mentioned that perhaps there is an overarching question here as to what is the main goal of Bezdin. That is the main goal of Bezdin to try to paskin accurately in terms of reality? Or is the main goal of Bezdin to try to bring peace? And what is our default position? So, for example, will we try to split things, yachloku, as a preferred default because it's nice and peaceful, as long as it's not going to cause us other problems? Or will we only do that if we have some compulsion to do so? because we'd rather do something that is more likely to be MS in terms of the historical reality, which might be called Olam Gvar. Right, we mentioned the name of Rav Lichtenstein that called Olam Gvar 50% of the time you're 100% right, and in the case of Yachloku, 100% of the time you're 50% right. So what do we prefer? We prefer peace at the expense of accuracy. We prefer accuracy even if it means that it's not going to be harmonious. So we saw that seems to reflect itself in different Rishonim. What's the default? What's the preference? And those were some of the issues that we laid out over our first few shiurim, our first few discussions of these topics. Does everyone feel significantly refreshed in that landscape? Anybody want to throw out any questions? Anything want to be clarified before we go further? Okay, so we're back in the sugya a little bit. We're back in the theme. Okay, so as we mentioned, there was an X factor that frequently got invoked, and that is this mysterious Drarud Mamona. And a lot of times I had to ask you to kind of set aside a holding place in your mind so that we could talk around it, because it's unclear what it means. So now the day has finally come. We'll try to figure out what exactly Drarud Mamona is and see how does it plug back into our understandings, and hopefully we'll get some type of satisfying perspective as to how this fits into our discussion. So where does Drarud Mamona come up? Why is it a part of our vocabulary? Where does it come up in our discussions? How do we know the term? Sorry?
Simchus.
So it comes up in terms of discussing Simchus. So the first place we encounter, you know, we meaning us, we're learning Bav Metzia now, the first place we encounter Drarud Mamona, it's a little bit of a distraction. Because the answer is Bav Metzia Daf Beis. But there's two different ways of saying that. One is the Gemara in Bav Metzia Daf Beis in the Beis. And that's a little bit of a distraction. Because we also come up to it through the Rishonim in Bav Metzia Daf Beis, and that's more relevant to what we're interested in. So if we learn Bav Metzia Daf Beis, we'll find that word in our Gemara, but it's kind of a little bit in a side context, and it's a little bit of a distraction. While it's more significant the fact that the Rishonim are invoking it. Right? The Rishonim invoke it in order to try to explain practically why we do one plan over the other. And usually when the Rishonim invoke it, what does Drarud Mamona support? Which of the plans, which of our various strategies?
Yachloku,
right? If there is Drarud Mamona, so then we're more likely to do Yachloku, let's say, than, for example, Kol D'Olam Gvar. And that's pretty much an explicit Gemara, really, elsewhere. It's a Gemara where? In Baba Basra. Right? And Daf Lamed Hey. Right? There, the Gemara talks about the situation where we say, Zeomer Shalavosai, Vizeomer Shalavosai. Right? This is a Gemara in Lamed Hey and Lamed Vav. It's a Bible very short in Baba Basra, so it covers a few pages. Right? There, the Gemara talks about if you have two people fighting over a plot of land, so the preference is for Kol D'Olam Gvar. And the Gemara goes on to say, why is it that we prefer Kol D'Olam Gvar? And the Gemara mentions two issues. One issue is Ikalam Ekam Ala D'Milsa, that there is what that's out there to be found, is what that can be clarified. Maybe we'll just look at the Gemara together to give us some clarity. So I don't know if you have a Babasa's review, but I will be happy to meet you once the daf comes up. Just taking a second. Try it this way. Alright, so the Gemara says, in Vambadalim and Bezim Baba Basra, Ze Omer Shalavosai, Ze Omer Shalavosai, two people fighting over land, Amr of Nachman, Kolda Alum Ram. That seems to be the policy. So, Maishna Mishtei Shtaros Hayotzos Biyom Echad. So, what's the difference between the case of two Shtaros, two people fighting, each one has a Shtar supporting their possession? The Rav Amar Yachloku, Shmuel Amar Shud the Daini. That one of these two alternatives is preferred in that case. So, Hasam Lekalamekam Allah Demilsa.
Okay, so Mekam Ademilsa is one of the reasons to say called the Alam Gvah. Achikla Mekam Ademilsa. Umayishna mehadi tanan, amachlif par bachamar. Yolda, v'chein ha-mokher shevchasu v'yolda, zeh omer ad shel macharti yolda, v'zeh omer mishel akachti yolda, yachloku. So what about the case where either a shifcha or an animal changed hands and there was a child born at some point, and we don't know whether the child was born before the sale or after, so we don't know who owns the offspring. And there the psak is yachloku. So what's the difference? So says the Gemara, Lahai Islay Dra'ar de Mamona, Ulahahu Islay Dra'ar de Mamona. There is Dra'ar de Mamona. Hacha I Demar lo Demar, vi Demar lo Demar. While in this case, they're fighting over the land, it's one or the other. So whatever Dra'ar de Mamona there means, it means apparently to support Yachloku. And we'd say Yachloku if it was Dra'ar de Mamona. And in the case of fighting over the land, each one says it's theirs. Called Olam Gvar. So that's part of why our Gemara above Metziah Daf Beis and Beis is a little bit of a distraction, because there Dra'ar D'Mamona is used kind of to work against our Mishnah above Metziah Beis and Aleph, because our Mishnah is presented as a case there that's less Dra'ar D'Mamona. So that's why it's a little bit confusing and a little bit of a distraction. But our Gemara says that we're surprised that we have to have a Shvua for Yachloku, because we have Yachloku without a Shvua in other cases where there is Dra'ar D'Mamona, and our Mishnah is no Dra'ar D'Mamona. But the whole premise seems to be that our Mishnah is Dra'ar D'Mamona, because if Yachloku was associated with Dra'ar D'Mamona, and our mission is classic Yachloku, it sounds like it is a case of Dra'ar D'Mamona. So that's part of why our Gemara is confusing with this phrase. And it's a little bit of a distraction. So our main interest of Dra'ar D'Mamona is not so much above Metziah Daf Beis and Beis, but it's really from the Rishonim on the Mishnah, Daf Beis and Aleph, trying to figure out why I say one or why I say the other. But of course, much of the discussion will center on the usage of the phrase in this Gemara, which again makes it even more confusing than it could have been otherwise. But it sounds like, in general, from the Gemara in Bava Basra and from the usage in a lot of the Rishonim, that Dra'ar D'Mamona supports Yachloku. And there's also a Tosus in the beginning of Bava Basra that talks about what? Then when Daf Beis Min Aleph from Bava Basra talks about the wall that collapses. And Tosfos there, it's essentially Yachloku. That's what the Mishnah says, that it's Shel Shnehem. It's another way of saying Yachloku. And Tosfos contrasts it with the case of the boat, Hahu Arva, the boat that two people are fighting over, and we say Kol Dalam Gvar. So Tosfos says, well, how do we see that case? The case of the collapsed wall is a case of Dra'ar D'Mamona. And that's a controversial Tosfos we'll get to later to try to figure out why that's so controversial and how to understand it. But it sounds like, for the most part, like Dra'ar D'Mamona is something that tends us towards Yachloku. We'll see there may be some chips in that armor, but for the most part, that's the impression we get. So if that's the case, so now let's try to work with that, and let's try to figure out what does Dra'ar D'Mamona mean. So we need to translate the words. And as we're trying to look at some of the possible translations, so we could think, and I encourage your comments on this, if it's a given translation, why is that translation relevant? Why would that make me think, Kol Da'alam Gvar, no, Yachloku, yes, or any other such possibility? And so there are two things happening here. We're trying to translate the term, and the translation should make a difference. It should have some relevance to what we're talking about and fit in somehow to a pattern. And then we'll see how does all of this enlighten us in terms of our broader understanding of what we've been talking about. So what definitions have we seen in terms of Kol Dalam Gvar? Anybody want to throw out any? There are at least, let's say, four. Even though some of them you might count together, it could be they're all pointing in the same direction. But they're
There probably are at least four. Hi?
Kol Olam Kvar would kind of say, like,
Bidin. Ah, so that Vuleka of Tanaseim is Yesh Safek without Tanaseim. That's Tosus' interpretation, right? That without their Tainas, there would still be a Safek. Yeah, so that's a very major one. I think I want to get to that one fourth. So that's definitely one of them. We'll come back to that. What else do we see?
Please.
Chisara. Right, so kiss is the word you're going to translate for Mamona. Right, so Drara being Chisara. So who says like that?
Rashi.
Rashi. Right, so that's the first one we'll encounter. So number one we'll call Chisaron. Number four we'll invoke Tosus, that there's a suffix without their tainas. What else? Shaychus. Right, so that's we'll call that one number two. And which one is similar to that but might get another slot at the table?
Tvias Mamon.
Tvias Mamon, very good. Okay, so let's start off with those four possibilities. So let's say first Chisaron. So who says like that? Rashi says like that. Rashi on Beis and the Beis, who is suggesting that, again, in a confusing way, that our Mishnah is not a case of Drarar de Mamona. So Rashi says, Drarar de Mamona, Chisaron Mamon. Shemi Parazesh Shalokidin, Havi Chisaron Mamon. That in a situation where something either belongs to one person or the other, is talking about yet another case of Gemara and Bava Kamma, which for simplicity we won't go into the details now. But if somebody gets paid without that being correct, so then that person who's paying is going to lose that money. That if a person who should pay is not going to get paid, is not going to pay, then the person who loses out is not going to be paid. So there's going to be a loss of money in that situation. While in this case, let's keep it simple, let's talk about the mitziah. So it sounds like there's no actual loss of money because two people are fighting over a windfall. They're fighting over profit. So nobody is running the risk here of being deprived of their funds. So that's how Rashi translates it. Chisaron as a loss. And that's how some, if you look in the Encyclopedia Talmudis and some of the Rishonim like the Aruch, think you have a tradition of translating that word that way, that drara means a loss. So if you look at the Rashba, you get a chance to see the Rashba? Anyone see the Rashba? So let's look at it together a little bit. If I had a projection screen and a digital file, I would, and a lot of other things, I would project it onto the screen. But basically, what does the Rashba say? So the Rashba quotes Rashi, first of all, right? Perish Rashi, Zal, Drorah, Demamona, Chisaron, Kit, Shim, Techaivo, Techaivanu, Shalokidin, Harechasa, Mamon, etc., etc. Klomar, he fills in, Lafuke, Mitzia, Delav, Mide, Chasa, Lafuke, Mecha, Chumemcher, Dekamahadele, Dami. In other words, to exclude our situation, either the Mitzia, where nobody is investing anything, or the purchase situation, where the guy who loses out will get his money back. So in our Yachloku in the Mishnah, it seems like there's no Drar de Mamona. So says the Rashba, the same thing that's bothering us, as we said before, it's confusing about this Gemara. Says, Ve'in Perusho Nira Mechuvar. This is not something that's clear to me. Mi Damrinan Perichezka Sabatim, Ze Omer Shalavosai, Vize Omer Shalavosai. Amr of Nachman called El Mgvar, Ve'akshinola. Me'amachlef parabachamor, v'yalda, zelmer b'rshusi yalda, zelmer b'rshusi yalda, etc. Tarasla, hasam ikka jarjo amon olamar lamar. So quoting from that Gemara in Bava Basra, so says the Rashba, v'iki perusha shol Rashi, v'ahi d'zelmer shalavosai gamkein b'es pechisaren kiss. So isn't there a chisaren kiss in that case? You have two people fighting over one piece of property. One's the rightful owner, one's not. So one guy is going to lose out by, let's say, a split. He'll end up losing. Lose half his property. Or if any other result could also involve a loss. He goes on to say, Shemidakfu Misha Eino Shalavosav, the Mishu Shalavosav, if the guy who's not really telling the truth ends up stronger, Nimso Chaser Sadeyu. So the guy who's right is going to lose his field. Why is that not Drarar de Mamona according to Rashi's definition? So, for that reason, initially, the Rashba challenges Rashi's definition, And that gets us into the definition of some of the other Rishonim. We'll talk about what that is, the Rashba, in the end, to skip his middle for a second, because it's relevant to some other points. So to go, this is a three-paragraph Rashba, so to go to the third paragraph for a second. So the Rashba then points out what was bothering us, that our Gemara is not so consistent with the way the Rishonim discuss it. Right? Essentially, it's the same question. He's asking it a little bit differently, but that it seems as if the Rishonim talking about Jarad Mamona and Bav Metzia Beis and the Beis are not really in sync with each other. So says the Rashba in the end, says he acknowledges that the flow of our Gemara, Beis and Beis, Gimel and Aleph, does work with Rashi. So Rashi's interpretation fits our Gemara, it just doesn't fit into the rest of Shas. So therefore, he concludes after having questioned Rashi. He says at the end, Al Kain Nirali, the Hafa Perish Drarud Mamona Hefsid Mamon. That here it means Hefsid Mamon, like Rashi says. Vahasam Perish something else, which we'll come back to in a second, but Basra means something else. Vahashan Echaru Amaschat Lashneim Yanim. Vishlanu Kazeh Habe Betalmud. This is one thing that means two, it's one phrase that means different things, and we have that a lot in Shas. Alright, so it's not consistent. So the usage of the Gemara here is different than the usage of Bava Basra and the way the Rishonim are using it. So that's one interpretation, basically. Rashi's interpretation that we're talking about a loss of money, and it's difficult with some of the other sources, so perhaps we could save Rashi with Rashba and say it means it only in the context of this Gemara, but not elsewhere. If you say that it's chisar and mamon, so how does that influence us in terms of how we should say, if we use this interpretation, so how does that influence us in terms of what path to take, yachloku, kol dam uvar, etc., etc.? If that's what it means, if it means a chisar and mamon, someone's going to lose out. So which one of our various approaches should we take because of that? Jonathan?
So the base thing can't give the real MS answers, they're going to try and do the best they can. So they're going to have to do Yachloku just in order to...
Is Yachloku the best they can in terms of closest to MS?
Because no matter what, there's going to be a Drarad Mamona if they do a Koldel and Gvar situation.
But maybe Yachloku then is going to exacerbate the Drarad Mamona, because it means they're definitely robbing somebody to have half of his property.
Right.
Maybe this definition of Drarad Mamona is a reason not to do Yachloku. Which is actually the context in which it's invoked here. Right? What do you think?
Yeah, it seems it's a no-win case.
So maybe you'd say something like, or maybe I'll say Kol Dal and Gvar. Why would I say Kol Dal and Gvar in that case?
Might get lucky,
or so I have at least
hope it'll work out,
let's say might get lucky. Also, if I say that it may depend on what we saw in the Machlokas, how to understand Kol Dal and Gvar, right? How might it depend?
If
it's a beer, then maybe I'm less likely to do it, possibly. So, you want to comment?
I was going to say the same thing, that if it's a beer, then if the guy's going to fight harder, then it's all in all possibility the rightful owner is going to get it back.
Okay, so you're saying within the beer, that maybe will push harder for the beer, but maybe this works even better if you say the other way. I don't know, Aaron, if you're about to say this, if you say that it's a sibuk. I will say, listen, Bezdin will get out of the way and let the parties come as close to the truth as they can. And either way, Bezdin will not be responsible for whatever happens. So it's not clear, this definition of Chisar and Mamon, which really is favored only by Rashi here, and it's only in Rashi in the context that's limited, which doesn't necessarily show Yachloku, it's not clear what I would say as an approach if this is how I translated Jarad Mamon. But we see that a lot of Rishonim, in the context of the broader issue of how do we divide up, how do we deal with a conflict, translate Drarud Mamona differently. So, for example, what did we say was number two on our list?
Shaychus.
So who says Shaychus? The Muki Yosef, right? Very good. Who else? Shitamukubatsa, that's right. Shitamukubatsa, that's above Metzia says it, right? Does the Rashbam say it? Rashbam and Bava Basra? It's
says something along those lines. But let's look at the Nimuki Yosef. Who mentioned Nimuki Yosef? Somebody over here? Okay, right, Roni? So let's take a look at what the Nimuki Yosef actually says. So the Nimuki Yosef commenting on that Gemara in Bava Basra, when he says, Gerard Ramona, he says, L'chol Echad Yesh Shaychus B'mamon Zeh. That to each party there is a relevance, there is some type of connection. Lefisha Haisa B'chezkaso Ad Achshav. I'm sorry, actually, this is a part of the sentence. Lefisha L'chol Echad Yesh Shaychus B'mamon. Each one has a relevance to the money. Zeh Lefisha Haisa B'chezkaso Ad Achshav. V'zeh Lefisha Hi Achshav Shalom. Right, the two parties who are involved, each one has a connection. One owned it previously, and one owns it now. V'chol echad yochal liton parasi v'shivchasi haisa kishiyalda. That each one can claim it was mine at the time. Inami efshar sheyalda b'shas chalipin. Ve'ein livror shall mi havlai. Or it's also possible that this happened at the time when it was switching over. And we can't really figure out, there's no real truth to who is the actual owner. Helkach yachloku, v'lo amrin hachashuda. So that goes reaches another interesting possibility. But then the next Dibra HaMaschil, Idemar, which is commenting on where the Gemara says, as opposed to a yachloku case, the case where they're fighting over the land, it either belongs to one or the other, idemar, idemar. So it says in Mukhi Yosef over there, davka hu shel echad bebirur, ve'ein lehem lebezdin, lipsok. Right, that it's davka one or the other, and therefore bezdin is not going to get involved, essentially. So how is the Mukhi Yosef, and this is a view that a lot of other Rishonim share, how is he understanding this phrase of Dvarud Mamon? So Shaychus, what does that mean, Shaychus? How would we understand that? How do we translate it? How do we apply it? What's he saying, Shaychus? Jonathan?
At some point or another, each party had a certain Shaychus, or I guess claim, or anything to do with what's being disputed.
Okay.
So therefore, since they don't know when the birth actually happened, when it could have been during any of their ownerships, any of their shaykhuses.
So therefore, what does that mean? Aaron, do you want to expand on that?
I mean similar to us, just the extent that even in a case where we don't know their shaykhus, in the case of the whole suffix is based upon their timeless, so in that case, one of them is claiming that he's shaykhus. So the question is, why is it different when we know that he's shaykhus to it based upon his previous ownership of it, or in a case where we don't know he's shaykhus, who's claiming that he's shaykhus in it, like a case of Likadur at the moment?
See, what you're asking, what's the difference between, let's say, the boat case or the land case, where somebody is claiming shaykhus,
right,
as opposed to a case with actual shaykhus?
Right.
You're asking that question?
Yeah. I mean,
so how would you answer? What are they getting at here?
I think that the...
So I want to address your question?
Yeah,
you
the shaykhus is indisputable by both parties.
Okay, so they definitely have a connection. What does that connection do for them? Why does that make us treat the case differently? I mean, right, so in the case of where they're fighting over a boat, so you have two people fighting, one guy could be a total interloper, right? It has nothing to do with anything, and he decides, okay, free boat, I'll try to fight and see what to do with it. But why should that lead us to treat the things differently? Ali?
There are no additional parties that could be involved in the case of the para.
That's interesting. That's something we mentioned when we talked about Yachloku last month. We talked about one of the reasons why we may say that over other things is maybe we say it when we can control the area of the litigants. If we say it, we know that it's these two people as opposed to anyone else. But it sounds like they're saying something more than that here. It sounds like that's a negative point. You know, that essentially we know there's nobody else who's got at least this much of a claim. But here it sounds like they're talking about something positive. That there's something that each party has that gives them something. Aaron?
Maybe I know some that are in like Shmuel Zefti, the fact about that you're that you use that as that even if you're claiming shaykhus, which is true that we don't know your definite party, it may not be the fact that we know that these are the only two people. It could be that by you having ownership of previously in a case of suffix, you now have some schus in the object that
so that gives you some type of a claim in the object itself, or it gives you
the schus to our attention, let's say. You know, it gives you the right to our attention because we know that you're, we know that you're a player. We know that you are somebody who has some rights to the situation. And
I mean, for not only that you're the first one, I mean, not that you only have a schus, that we know you're one of the people, that it gives you even further schus than that.
It's sort of like, you know, the actual monetary right, like you therefore have some ownership, or it means that we have to pay attention to you, or somewhere in between.
Okay.
Somewhere in between. Okay, so that's it's an interesting thought, Ellie.
Well, if you have to pay, even if it's just that you have to pay attention to the person, and there are two people who you have to pay attention to, there's nothing that you can do beyond that because there's no do beyond that because the situation itself is suffering, then it would make sense why you would.
It makes sense why you'd be forced to yachloku because you have to pay attention to them.
To both of them, and you can't pay more attention to one and create a.
So essentially, maybe what these Rishonim are saying is that if two people have an equal claim to your attention, each one says, listen, why should you pay any more attention to the first guy than me? He owned it yesterday, I own it today. And the other guy will say, well, he owns it today, I owned it yesterday. So therefore, they both essentially come with equal standing, and therefore, we'll have to say, I got nothing. I got 50-50, and I have nothing to tilt me to one direction or the other. Which kind of sounds like something else. What does that sound like? It sounds like a, an intellectual form of ochsin. You know, it sounds that essentially, we're saying that if two people are physically holding something, each one has a certain claim. And now if two people both come with some type of a intellectual connection to something or some type of a historical connection, so that's also comparable to Ochsin. Aaron?
This is sort of what I said before, that this it's sort of a, if we already know these only two players, it's sort of a base now is an authorized to them. In that case, you probably wouldn't say call them Kavar because in that case, it's possible that the one who's actually is going to get taken away from him, whereas the one who the rightful owner will lose completely. We have to say yachloku. Since Basin now has the rights of both two partners, so if you say yachloku, then we know for sure that the one who it actually is going to get at least part of what he previously had.
So you're working off again like an ochsin kind of story. This is basically an intellectual ochsin, so to speak. And instead of having the physical property being held, they are both entering their historical achiza, which is a very interesting idea. Jonathan, have you had anything in your book yet?
Yeah, I think it could be even stronger than calling it an intellectual oxen because, or stronger than regular oxen because by regular oxen it could very well be, and the Gemara doesn't sound like what their arguments are, is that, you know, theoretical arguments in terms of we got here at the same time, I think it's mine. It sounds like each of them is saying, this is mine. Like this, I truly believe this belongs to me. And the case is in like Makuf Para. It doesn't really sound like they're saying, I truly believe, you know, it's a claim.
They don't really know.
Right, they don't really know. My claim is it happened while it was in my property. So here, Basin is even more, you know, neither, Basin recognizes that neither one of them has any real assertion to, like real ability to assert any dominance over the other one. Whereas in all the other cases, including Schneimokels, and it could be that like the litigants themselves legitimately believe that, you know, this rightfully belongs to me. And in the case of land, obviously one of them's right and one of them's wrong. Here, even they know that like it's not necessarily that way. They're just saying like, if I want to get it, I have to say the following. You know.
So it's an interesting distinction to keep in mind to just figure out what exactly we want to see from that distinction. So we say, we talk about, let's say, actual ochsin. So we're saying each one has their claim, and they're using their achiza to prove their claim. In the case of, let's say, parav uchamar, so they're not really claiming that they know something happened. They say, all of us, the three parties here, the two litigants and the bezdin, none of us know what happened. So we have a certain standing, which we use to advance our right to be the one declared the winner, which is not connected to our knowledge of what actually happened, and that is the claim itself. I have to figure out to what extent that's going to color things, but that is an interesting distinction. Who was up? I think someone was up before.
I think that the concept of Chazaka by the Machpar is stronger than with the Talis, because the Talis just right now we see Komasha Tapasi on the shoulder, we assume that it's serious, but we can't make any judgments on what happened. Like, we can only work with what we have now. If we're going to Chazaka from back then, that you actually had it at one point in time, and it was like honestly yours, I think that's stronger.
Well, see, it's an interesting question because there's some room to discuss on both sides. But when it comes to the Shnei Mochus and Batalis, so that was part of what we spent some time in before Yantif, the question of how significant is it that you're holding? Is it very minorly significant? Is it majorly significant? Do we really think it means anything about the history here? Is it just that it's irrelevant to the history, but you're holding it, so that gives you a certain monetary rights? It's somewhat of an open question as to how much weight to give to that achiza. So on that side of the question, you have to figure out exactly how to assess that. On this side of the question, so that's also a question how much to assert, because when we talk about a chazaka, so we don't really have any knowledge when this happened. So what's more significant, the fact that he owned it yesterday, the fact that this guy owns it today? Is it that one really tells us more about the historical accuracy, or is it really also just a collection of rights? So we'll say whoever has the strongest history, the strongest set of rights, baggage full of rights, should win. And in this case, they come out basically 50-50. I'm not sure if there's a pressure to do something different.
No matter how you define Dror de Mamona, the Gemara calls it Dror de Mamona. Like, that term doesn't seem to be saying it's a positive thing that they each have some sort of ownership in it and therefore they have a stronger claim, like everyone's been saying. No matter how you define it, it seems like Bezin doesn't want to take it away from whoever the rightful owner is.
Well, you're saying it doesn't sound like that because you think
the
word
Dror de Mamona doesn't
you're assuming it's translated as a negative phrase?
That's just how it sounds to me. Yeah, no matter how you define it. What it
sounds like it means lost, like Chisar.
Yeah.
Right, so that's a bias which may or may not be accurate. So some of the Rishonim assume that that's the case, but we're not really sure how to translate, even just from linguistically, we're not sure how to translate it. And if we looked at a few other places, so in the context of Tuma, what does it mean there? So the Rishonim explain it both ways, right? It could mean that it's a negative kind of thing, we're afraid. So just parenthetically, so this is also now where it comes up. So some of you got to see there's a Gemara in Nida and a Gemara in Chagiga, which some of the Rishonim invoke, where the Gemara has the word Dror with another word, Dror de Tuma. And the Gemara says that we list certain things. We're trying to figure out about how we treat Kudshim differently than how we treat Truma. And some things make the list and some things aren't mentioned. So the Gemara says the things that were mentioned are things where there's a Dror de Tuma. So it sounds like it means that there is a connection to actual Tuma. So that gives the list a certain chashivas. So in that context, you could say it's a fear, so to speak, like Rashi translates in the Chagiga as a chashash tumah.
Or just some sort of connection.
Or a connection. That's a Tosfos in Nida, sounds more like it's a connection. So it's hard to know exactly what is the linguistic history, what is the etymological history of the word, to know what is more likely. So some of the Rishonim and the Aruch, etc., do have this loss connotation, but again, Rashi calls it a chisar here is probably commenting on a different kind of Dror de Mamona, like the Rashba says. So there's a lot of confusion, there's a lot thrown around. So I don't know if the Gemara in Bava Basra has to mean it in a negative way for the parties. And even if it does, even let's say we translated it there as a lack, it means a lack to people who have a right. You know, you have a right to something, and if you're going to lose out, you're going to lose on your right. So by calling it a loss to you, that's an inverse way of saying you have a schus, and that your schus is at risk, so that's a Dror de Mamona. So even using the negative translation could also support essentially a positive statement. You're saying you have a stake. And a stake, let's say you use a good English equivalent perhaps, a stake in something means you have something at stake, something which you could lose, and the fact that you could lose it means it's something that's really yours. So I don't know how much we can darshan from the particular focus of the language. Jonathan.
Contrary to what was said before, though, in the case of Machlev Parah, it's not that you can't necessarily say that they're not really arguing that it's mine, that they're arguing that we both have some sort of shaifas or whatever. The lashon of the mission is that they're both saying it's shalihu.
Right.
So it's not that they're... It's that the Beis Din has this issue that they have to figure out that all both have a shaykhus, but both of them seem to be legitimately claim that it's really mine.
Although I don't know what we mean by the shali. When they say shali, they mean, I think Jonathan's probably right, that they don't think... It's unlikely that anyone thinks that they historically know that it's theirs. It means that, look, this is undetermined. And since it's undetermined, I have the best claim to come get it. That because I own it today, the undetermined should be mine. And the other one says, because I owned it yesterday, the undetermined should be mine. So Bezdin should give it to me because of my package of claims that are irrelevant here. So that kind of transitions us into another definition, which you mentioned might be the same or might be a little bit different, and that is I think Aaron had mentioned it before, right? The tvias mamo, that a claim, a monetary claim, which it could be a different way of saying shaychus. You could view it the same way, or you could see this as another interpretation, that somebody has some basis to say something is theirs. So, for example, who uses this phrase tvia? I think somebody mentioned it before. Well, the Ritva, for one, uses it. So if you got a chance to see the Ritva is in Baba Basra and Daf Lamed Hei Man Aleph, over there in that Gemara. So, commenting on the words there, Deika Drara de Mamona Lekol Chad, says the Ritva, Perish Drara de Mamona, Iker Tvia. Means they have some basis for a claim. Milashan Drara de Tuma. So here he somehow reads from that language of Drara de Tuma that this means Iker Tvia. It's not really clear how he sees that, but connecting it to that, he makes that deduction, and he quotes Targum Yerushalmi. The Targum Yerushalmi, we don't really have the Yerushalmi this way, even though a lot of Rishonim, the Ramban and Bava Metzia has it also. But the Yerushalmi on the Pasuk in Miketz, where Yehuda says about Binyamin, Miyadi Tevakshena, that if anything happens to Binyamin, you come get him from me. So the Targum is alternately rendered as Tadrichena, which doesn't seem to help us so much, or the way he has it here, Tadarirena. And apparently Drara, come claim it from me, that's what the word Drara means. So he goes on to say, Kolomar kolechad yeshlo zika v'ikr b'tviyazu. Everyone has a connection, zika, if you're learning Yuvamas last year, so that's a familiar word. Right? You have a connection to this claim. Kikevan she'avlat hazeh haya b'para. Since this was inside the cow once upon a time, and the seller had that cow once upon a time, so that's a basis for a claim. And the purchaser is his now. So if it did, that should seem to create a situation of yachloku. Unless, except for the svar of Rabbanan, the Gemara over there, that there is a reason to prefer one claim over the other. But essentially, what seems to be the Ritva's presentation is that we're talking about a tviya, and the next comment he says also, the contrasting comment, he says, where e demar kula lo demar kula, that it's one or the other, so it says the Ritva over there, ve'ein l'shnehem mamish ikr z'chus al tviya zos. None of them have an actual claim. So this could just be another way of saying shaychus, or it could be a slightly different perspective. If we want to define shaychus in a more minimalist way and say each one's got a seat at the table, you know, we can't ignore either party, or like Eli started off to say that we've narrowed it down to these two, so that just might mean that these are our players, but not necessarily focusing on the substance of any specific claim. Well, maybe some of these Rishonim are taking a little bit further and saying that Dvarad Mamona means that if you have some actual way of being able to express not only a connection, but how that connection makes this yours, so then that's also something to be paid attention to. So I doubt any of you saw, for example, along these lines, and you can take a look at it tomorrow, the Shita Mekubetzes in Bava Basra. You're more likely to have seen Shita Mekubetzes as in Bava Metzia, but Shita Mekubetzes in Bava Basra, which was towards the end of the Marmar Komos anyway. So, if you look at the way the Rabbeinu Yohonasan, that the Shita Mekubetzes quotes, formulates it, it's a little more direct. Says Rabbeinu Yohonasan over here in the Shita Mekubetzes, V'yesh meforshim, the chol echad yesh lo taina aleha. Each one has a claim. Shalokeach yachol omar, ani lo hayisi nosein ba'damim ke'elu, im lo shedati al havlad haya.
that the purchaser would have said, I would not have paid so much if I didn't think that I was also getting the offspring. That's why I paid as much as I did. V'hamocher yachalomar lo hayisi nosei nosa bedamim ko'elu in lo shohaya bedaiti limkor havlad. And the seller could say, I would not have, this is, seems to be phrased a little bit off, presumably what he means to say is that the seller could say, I would not have given it for this price if not had it been my intention to not sell the lot as well. So he takes it a little bit further. And it's not just that each one has a history, each one has some type of connection, but that they're articulating the claim in some way. That when I did this, I had this in mind, and this is part of the detail, and this is my standing at the table. So two hands up at the same time, but Aaron hasn't Menachem hasn't spoken yet, so we'll...
Wouldn't we then check out the prices?
Maybe.
Wouldn't we be able to determine it based on that?
Possibly. What he seems to be assuming is that there's enough variability and that each one can claim. In my mind, I thought this would be a fair price for both, and the other one's saying, I think this would be a fair price just for the mother. And essentially, whenever you have a seller and a buyer, they usually have different ideas of where the market should be. So it makes sense that whatever the number is, the seller thought that was a reasonable price just for the minimal product, and the purchaser thought it was the proper price for the full product. So you can see how that's how there is such a difference. Okay.
No matter what the case was in that, when it was born, if they're giving that different claims, especially because the original model is saying you wouldn't have sold it, and the guy's saying I wouldn't have bought it, it's a megapathos, and they just return the money, and that's the end of it.
Possibly. That's an interesting question, whether that really raises the specter of a megapathos.
He's saying that's what they thought.
Yeah, that's an interesting halachic question. You know, goes back to the issue of current Yonah Dioma that the El Al Tekefa keeps coming up. The question of what defines a megapathos. And that's a very interesting topic to bring up. You know, that if two people are dealing honestly with each other,
which is because he thought differently,
right? You know, so two people are honestly telling each other all the facts, and there's no concealed information. But just one person said, "Oh, you know, I'm thinking this is what I'll get, so I'll offer this price." And whether or not that's a megaphtos is an interesting question. So it could be that that is an avenue for the Rebbeinu Yehonasan to explore the next step. And maybe that's part of what they'll come to Bezdin. They'll come to Bezdin and say, oh, I have a claim for a Mekav Tos. Now, especially here, since nothing is
and
spoken out.
I'm sure, so maybe that's like the Yachloku kind
of. Right, it's difficult to call it a real Mekav Tos because if nothing was spoken out, so it's going to be more of a ambiguous Mekav Tos. So either way, this is coming before Bezdin, and they're saying, listen, each one thinks they're entitled to the Vlad, and maybe the next step will be, okay, I don't get the Vlad, I think the whole sale should be canceled. I think that the whole issue is...
Contingent. So we give half, like we let each one have half there.
Possibly, but possibly what he's reflecting here is that this is also a part of the story that I'm saying not just that I think I deserve a perk, I deserve a bonus because it happened to be on my rights, but that this goes to the whole nature of the deal itself. So clearly, whether the Ritzvah is taking it to a different level, you could argue, but Rebbeinu Yehonasan certainly seems to be taking it to a new level, that it's not just a connection, but that somehow this also plays into the nature of your claim. Jonathan?
And again, we haven't really explored what the nothingness might be for this, but I think that this says, unlike what I was saying before, close to what Jonathan was saying, that if they come and they say it's mine, so then it's like, yeah, they have to say that. But if they come and say, like, I would never have made the sale otherwise, it sounds like maybe like they're coming to Beis Din and legitimately saying, thinking that they know the mitzvahs of the case and that it must be that it belongs to them and not that.
Correct. So that's a very important point, right? That Rebbeinu Yehonasan's, again, to tie the two Jonathans and Rebbeinu Yehonasan all seem to be linked here, that there's definitely a theme, that Rebbeinu Yehonasan is definitely adding a whole new level here. Right? Yes, so what you said before was definitely different. And for the other Rishonim, it's probably true. That for the other Rishonim, no one knows the truth here. We're assuming that the real truth, if we had Eliyahu HaNavi, or as actually some Sofer discusses, maybe you could have a situation where there actually was a witness who actually saw what happened, but it's extremely unlikely. But the premise until now, until you saw Rebbeinu Yehonasan, was that if we had some type of security footage we could check that would tell us when this baby was born,
that would satisfy the whole story. It's just a question that there's no way to figure out when it was born, so we have to just see whose rights are better. Rabbeinu Yohanan is saying something different here. He's saying that there was a deal. The deal was that this is being sold with or without the child. And the question is, which was the deal? Was it with or without? And each one is claiming an objective truth. Each one is saying that the deal was, I get it, regardless of when it was born. And the other one was saying the deal was, you don't get it. And that's essentially where their difference lies, which is a fascinating point. I haven't even addressed yet the rest of Rabbeinu Yohanan, because then he says something else, which opens up a whole other line. We probably won't be able to even talk about it today, but just be aware of it. And again, tomorrow, this is on today's list, so you can see it tomorrow. I'll send around with Jonathan the links if you want to, if you don't have Shittim HaKubetzes and Baba Basra, and you want to, with Jonathan will give you out copies from the from Hebrew books, so you could look at it inside. But he says here at the end, just to make things even more labedic, Inami Yeshlomar Shema Dashneim Hayalachlot Bavla B'Shas Chalipin. Maybe the deal was actually they were going to split it. And then that also further opens up a whole other discussion. What exactly is he getting at by saying that? So that's something the Chassam Sofer suggests, that maybe, is that what he's now entering a whole new element here, that maybe we were interested in this because Chaluki Yechol Yos Emes, and maybe that's what's going on, and that opens up a whole new door. So this is really a bombshell of the Shittim HaKubetzes. This is Rabbeinu Yohanan, he throws in so many new ideas here that he opens up all kinds of other avenues to what this whole Dvaru D'Mamona concept might be taking us to. Jonathan?
I think you kind of have to say that once you follow down the path of they're both legitimately thinking that this is correct, because otherwise it makes the case way too similar to all the other cases, that like it kind of loses why it is that we would be invoking Dvaru D'Mamona rather than anything else. But also, like,
as I said, they understand because in this case, it's similar to, let's say, the Arba case, because you have one item that two people are fighting over, and there's
so
no
when did it when did it become whose? When? But also, on a really maybe like Balabatisha level, why would a seller who's claiming the Vlad is mine sell the animal? Before, like, why would that happen? It's not like the animal, you know, you have.
Well, the claim will be that he wanted to play both sides of the fence. He wanted to get a good deal when he sold it, and then once it happened, he figures he'll try to claim the opposite in order to get it back. And
right,
deny that he ever said the first part.
Right, so I'm saying within the psychology of they both are true, like stating what they believe to be true, not the, like one would state that I would not have sold it otherwise, that's why it's mine, and the other one would say, no, why would I buy it for that price? So if there's a lot, then you have to say, like, no, the reason that they did the sale now is because the Vlad would have, like, part of the agreement was that they were going to split the...
See, it's actually interesting. Rabbeinu Yohanan actually really takes us on a whole roller coaster right here. Because, so as Aaron pointed out, it sounds like his last line was an effort to throw in Chaluki Yecholios Emes, that maybe there's actually a Metzius where there really is a 50-50 split here. But without his first comment, you could also have said Chaluki Yecholios Emes. Because we said he's entering in a whole new scenario here where the two parties are each claiming the actual truth is on my side. While according to the other Rishonim and the Pashtus of the Gemara, probably neither side thinks the truth necessarily is on their side. They say there's an unverifiable fact here. We don't know. There's a question we can't answer. So since we can't answer, what is the halachic truth? Maybe the halachic truth is that we should split it. That if there's no way to ever figure out who's right, nobody's lying, nobody deserves to be punished, there's no rami, just nobody knows the truth. So maybe halachic truth is, let it be split, there's a shared zchus, and that's, so maybe that is also a form of chaluki yechol yosemes. So maybe there's a couple ways to call this situation a situation of chaluki yechol yosemes because of the Dvaru D'Mamona, which makes it more yachlokus, and I think just someone had his hand up for a while.
I think that Lugias also mentioned it's this why it could be
right. Yeah, we didn't read that part.
Because he said that it could have been born at the exact time in the Chalipin, and that it actually belongs to both.
Right. I don't think we read that part the first time, but he did. He does say that at the end, which also possibly opens up new avenues for maybe a Cholios Emes, or maybe according to him, you could have had that anyway with the whole Iker, with the whole Shaychus concept. Okay. So before we run out of time. There's a lot more to say about this, so we at least want to get the fourth shita in, and tomorrow we'll try to bring it all together and see how some of the consequences play out. There's a lot of very fascinating points that will emerge from here. But what's the fourth shita? So I mentioned it before. It's probably the most famous shita, if we talk about the sugya without spending a lot of time on it, is Tosfos. Tosfos in Bava Basra, and Tosfos elsewhere. Tosfos in Cheskes Sabbat, not necessarily the Tosfos on that basically, but the Tosfos about Zelmer Shalav Osai. So it says Tosfos that the definition of Drar's Mamona is Heicha Dibaleka Tanoseihem Yesh Safek Rebezin. That it's not only that we have to worry about this because the two people are arguing, but that even if they weren't arguing, there still would be a Safek. So what's the significance of that? What does the words mean? Well, what's the significance of that? You don't want to comment on that? Why should that be a reason to say one way or another? I mean, there are a couple of different ways to look at it. And it sounds like it's saying that maybe it's significant because it means there's an inherent problem. There's a real situation here, and even if these two people didn't fight, then there's something that deserves our attention. Because the situation is inherently controversial. As opposed to a situation where maybe two people decided to start up, and had they not bothered us, we wouldn't have had to look at it at all. And maybe that means that we have more of a reason to get involved in such a situation. Well, let's say in the case of the Arba, we could say, listen, these two people are fighting because they started up a fight with each other, so let them continue to fight with each other. It's not our problem. It's not that there is an existing controversy that we have to address. Alternatively, it's interesting, you can look at it from a different angle. What else might be significant in saying, if we're putting all the focus on their taina, so then maybe the issue is Ramos. Maybe that opens up the consideration that the taina is itself a false one. When there's a real objective issue, and we don't need to look to their taina in order to create the issue, so it could be there's no Ramayin involved. When the problem is caused by them coming to Besdin and making a fuss, maybe that's a Ramai consideration, and maybe that pushes us in different directions. Aaron?
In the case of Ika during the moment, so it may make a taina where one of those lying differently.
There may be, but it's not necessarily an inherent part of the situation. That when the suffix comes from their taina, so if we assume that the taina itself is either right or wrong, it's a more black and white type of situation, so it sounds like we're talking about a kind of situation where one is lying. While if the situation is inherently controversial, so then we don't have to look to their tainas in order to have a suffix. In the case of the parva chamor, so we don't have to look to their tainas to have the problem. It's clearly that there's an issue.
It makes more sense to say that in a case where it's inherently suffix, that you basically knows that there's somebody who's robbed and somebody who's a robber. Mm-hmm. Even though they don't know who it is, they know that the way in which they can award the one who is robbed is by saying mechloku. Because then the thing was taken from him, or who rightfully is, will at least get half of what he had back.
But wouldn't we say robbed and robber? It's a little bit.
Not necessarily robbed and robber, but I mean,
because that would not be a case of the Ethel. You have to sharpen.
Right, right. No, not robbed and robber. I mean, the one whose object actually is, the one whose object that actually is. Then once they know who it is, now basically is that to give back to the one who rightfully is what he had. Whereas in a case where you don't even know who these two people are necessarily, so you basically is not as much right to figure out, well, first off, you guys actually want who it is, and then, so that's why I say cold and guard, I guess.
So therefore, which interpretation does that support?
Those
perhaps. Perhaps it should make sense according to that. Okay, show me the arena. Okay, so we have to continue this tomorrow, but one question I want you to think about for tomorrow is, do any of these explanations plug into a default preference. So would any of these be consistent with a preference for Yachloku or a preference of Kol Da'al and Dvar? One of the major issues that we started off talking about from day one. In other words, think about the question this way. Is Dvar D'mamona a reason why we have to say Yachloku, even though we'd rather say Kol Da'al and Dvar? Or is Dvar D'mamona something that allows us to say Yachloku? And we know that sometimes Yachloku is a problem because it means we're going to be stealing half of somebody's stuff. And that's why sometimes we find Rishonim preferring Kol Da'al and Dvar. Or sometimes we say that Kol Da'al and Dvar is bad because of its inherent problems of the might make right philosophy. So where does Dvar D'mamona fit in? Is it a reason that we're happy to have because it allows us to say Yachloku? Or is it a problem that stops us from saying Kol Da'al and Dvar when we want to, or any other combination thereof? So think about that, and tomorrow we'll take these four interpretations, or at least some of them, and see how they plug into that question, and how they plug into some other issues in the grand theories of Yachloku and Kol Da'al and Dvar. So just before you go, what did we talk about? We tried to figure out what Dvar D'mamona means to us in general. It's invoked in a couple of contexts. It's confusing because our Gemara invokes it in a context that sounds different than the way it comes up in other Gemaras and in the Rishonim on our very sugya, where it's used probably as a factor in favor of Yachloku. When you have Dvar D'mamona, you are likely to do Yachloku, even though our Gemara confuses us by invoking it as not an element of the Yachloku paradigm. And then we tried to figure out what the words mean and why that would push us in one direction or the other. And we saw probably what could be counted as, let's say, four different models. Rashi's translation of Chisaron, the Rashba pointing out that it doesn't work for other sugyas in Shas, and that maybe Rashi is right, but if he's right, he means it only in terms of this Gemara, and other Gemaras will have to mean something else. And therefore, the other interpretations of Shaychus Mammon, which a lot of the Rishonim have, Tvias Mammon, which might be another way of saying the same thing, or might be even sharper, might mean you have a claim, and a specific claim, the way some of the Rishonim articulate, and Rabbeinu Yohanan's especially powerful formulation with all of its consequences, and Tosus's view that the fact that the suffix is there inherently regardless of what they're saying, and the possible consequences thereof. All right, everyone should have a wonderful day. I will see you, God willing, tomorrow morning. And,